Welcome to Voicing Our Values, a series of podcasts about progressive message framing. This is the third segment entitled, How to Talk About Economic Fairness. I'm Bernie Horn, the Senior Director for Policy and Communications at the Public Leadership Institute, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that seeks to help progressive lawmakers and advocates, particularly at the state and local levels of government. Please take some time to look around our website, www.publicleadershipinstitute.org. In addition to the Voicing Our Values messaging handbook, you'll find the Progressive Agenda, which contains hundreds of policy ideas and more than 150 bills, our handbook for policy advocates called Preparing to Win, and much more. Our last podcast, number 2, explained 5 basic rules for persuasion, all of them designed to get around the problem of, quote, confirmation bias, which was explained in podcast number 1. To persuade, you need to understand your audience's preconceptions and where you share common ground. To avoid triggering negative emotional responses and confirmation bias, you must start from a point of agreement and provide a bridge from their preconceptions to your solutions. Along the way, show that your policies are consistent with values that they already hold dear and explain how they benefit. All this is designed to remind your listeners over and over and over again that you are on their side. The question now is, how do we apply these rules to specific issues like economic policy? Well, we believe that for the foreseeable future, the most powerful contrast between progressives and conservatives is and will be economic fairness. Progressives stand with the middle class, while conservatives side with the rich. This seems obvious, but Donald Trump has turned the contrast on its head, amplifying negative attitudes about people of color, to convince non-college-educated white voters that conservatives side with the middle class while progressives side only with people of color. We can take back that economic narrative in a way that clearly articulates that no one needs to be left behind, and we must. President John F. Kennedy repeatedly used the aphorism, quote, a rising tide lifts all boats. And it came to mean that a stronger economy benefits all Americans. At that time, Kennedy was correct. The benefits of increased productivity, that is, the creation of wealth across the U.S. economy, was fairly distributed to average workers from the post-war period into the Nixon administration. But starting in the 1970s and greatly accelerating during the Reagan administration, real compensation, that is, wages and benefits adjusted for inflation, stopped rising. While the economy continued to grow at a rapid pace, typical workers no longer received a reasonable share of the wealth that they helped to create. Instead, nearly all of the money was, and still is, diverted to the most affluent. This can be seen another way. A Congressional Budget Office report demonstrated that from the end of the Reagan administration to recent years, the richest 10% of Americans doubled their wealth, while the bottom 90% gained only slightly, and the bottom half, which owned just 1% of all the nation's assets, gained absolutely nothing. Today, the richest 1% of Americans own more private wealth than the bottom 95% combined. The 20 richest Americans own more assets than the entire bottom half of the U.S. population. And just 8 people, 6 of them Americans, own as much wealth as half of the world's population, that is, 3.6 billion people combined. While conservatives assert that this is just the normal functioning of, quote, the market, unquote, the redirection of wealth to the wealthy was consciously accomplished in many ways, large and small. Management pay was exponentially increased. Workers' benefits were minimized. key government regulations were amended or abolished, taxes were evaded, unions were destroyed, corporations sent factory jobs overseas, business cut costs by minimizing customer service and instead making the customer do part of the work. And most recently, Wall Street embraced money-making schemes that were little more than scams. The wealth that all Americans created together didn't just passively flow to the rich. It wasn't just the market in operation. The rich actively took it for themselves. If this sounds to you like a harsh assessment, we urge you to read about it yourself. It's essential to understand what underlies the populist uprising that fueled both the Trump and Sanders campaigns in 2016. Without knowing any of the details of charts and statistics and numbers, typical American workers feel that they've been treated unfairly, that their families are worse off than they were some decades ago, and that somebody is to blame for it. And in that, at least, they are right. Obviously, the right-wing media, owned by and operated for the rich, are not going to talk about the concentration of wealth. But neither will the mainstream media. Thus, the economic truth is both unseen and unheard. It remains hidden in plain sight, and as such, it can trigger some Americans to blame people of color, immigrants, low-income workers, and others, rather than the real culprits. Throughout his presidential campaign, Donald Trump told conservative voters exactly who to blame for their pain: people of color. He very vocally attacked Latinos and Muslims, and a bit more subtly attacked African Americans and anyone else who is not white. While Trump said this in the grossest ways, he was just expressing the right-wing narrative of grievance against non-whites that's been repeated for decades and which greatly increased in volume during the presidency of Barack Obama. What leaders of the right have been doing all these years is to encourage less educated white voters to make political decisions not based on policies that benefit them, but through the filter of their social identity. Psychology tells us that a great deal of average people's self-image comes from their social identity, the group or groups that they see themselves as a part of. Social identity divides the world into us and them, or the in-group and the out-group. The us can be something as unimportant as which football team a person supports. It can be about an individual's social class or family, college, or country. Being part of the group makes people feel good inside. It enhances pride and self-esteem. And usually there's nothing wrong with that. But people also enhance their self-image by denigrating the them. Like the subjects in Drew Weston's experiments that I talked about in the first podcast, individuals can feel good emotionally by blaming, being prejudiced against, or discriminating against their out-group. Surely Donald Trump seems to enjoy himself when he attacks his political opponents, and so do many of his supporters. In a political debate, there are two possible groups to blame for the troubles of non-college-educated whites. The truthful and rational explanation is that the rich have been, and still are, squeezing everybody else, making all of us relatively poorer. The phony emotional explanation is that it's the out-group, the non-whites. Persuadable voters tend to hold both of these beliefs in their heads. So how can we direct them to the truth? For at least a decade, virtually every poll has shown that if they hear the argument, persuadable voters will agree that the rich deserve blame. For example, among American voters, 72% agree, quote, "the American economy is rigged to advantage the rich and powerful. 83% say, quote, there are different rules for the well-connected and people with money, while only 14% believe, quote, everyone more or less plays by the same rules to get ahead. 85% say that the wealthy and big corporations are the ones really running this country. 67% think corporations are, quote, paying too little in federal taxes, unquote, while only 9% say that they are, quote, paying too much, and that's before the Trump tax cuts. 92% agree that, quote, there are already too many special interest tax loopholes for the wealthiest Americans, and 90% agree that too many are for corporations. Nevertheless, Barack Obama rarely made this point as president, and Hillary Clinton largely avoided it as a candidate. So the partisan debate on economics, what was heard by voters, was quite one-sided. This simply cannot continue. We can't win that way. This is an easy message to deliver because Americans already believe our narrative, if only we will say it. And there are many ways to communicate it effectively. For example, here's just one narrative. For typical working Americans, the economy is a wreck. To fix it, our policies must benefit all the people, not just the richest 1%. Our system works when everyone gets a fair shot, everyone gives their fair share, and everyone plays by the same rules. Now, why do we say that? Persuadable voters believe in a series of stereotypes about progressives and conservatives. In economic policy, persuadable voters like the concept of a conservative who supports low taxes and free markets. But they also believe that today's conservatives favor the rich rather than the middle class. At the same time, persuadable voters like a progressive who fights for economic fairness, but they also tend to believe that liberals favor the poor over the middle class. So pretty obviously, you need to emphasize that conservative policy supports the rich, while progressive policy supports the middle class. That doesn't mean that you should lessen your commitment to fight poverty or move your policies to the right. It means you should focus attention on the fact that your economic policies benefit the middle class while conservative policies don't. The narrative that I described a couple minutes ago uses simple, non-ideological language to express that idea. The first sentence expresses agreement. If you know something specific about your audience's economic woes, go ahead and use it. Don't imply that the economy is okay, no matter what the numbers say, because you'll likely get a very angry response. People don't feel that the economy is good. And the third sentence I used was by President Obama, and it polls very well. Here's another version of the same theme, different way of saying it. Our economy is upside down. The majority of Americans are struggling while the rich are doing better than ever. We need an economy that works for Main Street, not Wall Street. Every hardworking American should have the opportunity to earn a decent living, receive high-quality, affordable health care, get a great education for their children, and retire with security. Their policy favors the rich. Ours sides with the rest of us. Again, why do you say it that way? It's important to use language that explicitly blames the rich. A Hart Research poll demonstrated this by asking persuadable voters which candidate they'd support in two circumstances. When given a choice between a Republican who will, quote, grow the economy, and a Democrat who, quote, will make the economy work for all of us, the voters chose Republicans by 55 to 45. But when given the choice between a Republican who will, quote, grow the economy, and a Democrat who will, quote, make the economy work for all of us, not just the wealthy, they chose the Democrat by 61 to 39%. So by explicitly indicting the wealthy, the Democrat gained 16 points. Here's some additional phrases that work. Too often the system is rigged to favor the wealthy over ordinary Americans, or big corporations over small businesses. Or you could say, it doesn't have to be this way. We can change the rules. Or, we need an economy that works for all of us, not just the wealthy few. Or to build a strong economy, we need a strong middle class. Or you can say, it's time to rewrite the economic rules to benefit all Americans, not just the rich and powerful. Why these phrases? These narratives and messages appeal to just about every persuadable voter without sounding ideological. That's important because voters think that, quote, free enterprise has done more to lift people out of poverty, help build a strong middle class, and make our lives better than all of government programs put together. So, they're not ideologues. Don't attack capitalism. What you want to do is condemn economic unfairness. More specifically, don't say words like corporations or businesses are bad. Don't say anything negative about small business. Say Wall Street speculators, unfair tax breaks and giveaways to Wall Street. Say giant banks and major corporations. And say anything positive about Main Street. Main Street is very popular, while Wall Street is very unpopular. In fact, voters feel good about corporations and businesses. Most work for one. Voters believe that businesses create jobs and America needs jobs. Americans especially adore the concept of Main Street. As pollster Slinda Lake says, Americans are in love with small business. It's a concept that voters see as almost synonymous with America. And by small business, they mean family-run business with 5 or possibly 10 employees. You don't want to say income inequality or economic disparity. What you want to say is the richest 1%, the super rich, the billionaires, as opposed to all the rest of us. You want to talk about economic injustice or unfairness or the disappearing middle class. Understand that the rich or the major banks and corporations are not unpopular for who they are, it's for what they've done. To be effective, you need to connect the bad guy to the bad deed, such as unfair tax breaks, moving jobs overseas, accepting bailouts, or paying outrageous CEO bonuses. Americans expect some people to earn more than others. It's not income inequality that voters oppose. It's economic injustice, economic unfairness, and people who cheat or rig the system. So here's some more words. Don't say capitalism. Don't say free markets, free enterprise, free trade. On the other hand, do say the economic system isn't working for working families. Talk about fair markets, fair trade, a level playing field. Be against rigging the rules, gaming the system, stacking the deck. Be for an economy that works for all of us. Why is that? If you attack the market system, you marginalize yourself. In addition, there are lots of economic phrases that, in the minds of most Americans, may mean something different from what you intend. You don't want to say capitalism, socialism, or fascism because the far right has succeeded in confusing voters about their meaning. Don't use the phrases free markets or free enterprise because in this context, free triggers positive thoughts about conservative economics. And yet, you should explicitly support fair market economics, a fair market system. You need to draw a distinction between conservative anything-goes economics and a progressive system that enforces basic rules of the road to level the playing field and keep markets honest and fair for everyone. The argument for capitalism is that by harnessing individuals' economic drive, all of society is enriched by their hard work and innovation. And progressives are for that. But society does not win, and in fact, society loses, when people get rich by gaming the system, by exploiting tax or regulatory loopholes, by dismantling viable companies, or by creating scams that aren't technically illegal, but absolutely should be. Conservatives relentlessly warp markets to benefit the rich and powerful. They use subsidies, loopholes, trade policy, labor law, and economic complexity to corrupt markets. It's progressives who seek to build fair markets. Help voters visualize such a system, and here's another narrative that can help do that. We need an economy that's fair to everyone. That means structuring a system that not only rewards people for hard work and innovation, but also discourages people from gaming the system or passing costs on to the community. We need rules of the road that make economic competition fair, open, and honest. A fair market system energizes our economy, creates jobs, and allows every American to pursue the American dream. Why say it that way? Well, when you talk about the American dream, which is fair pay, health insurance, home ownership, education, retirement security, it provides the opportunity to explain that none of this is possible without a change in direction. It lays out an overarching goal. Only progressive policy will ever get us any closer to turning that dream into reality. Finally, when talking about economics, don't limit the conversation to income inequality. In our country, the biggest inequalities involve assets, like this. Our economic system should reward hard work and innovation. That's the American way. But right now, the richest 1% in America own more wealth than the bottom 95% of Americans combined. The rich don't need more subsidies and loopholes. They need to pay their fair share. In future podcasts, we'll show how to use our 5 basic rules of persuasion to debate a wide variety of other issues. In the meantime, do us a favor and recommend the Voicing Our Values series of podcasts to your friends. Best to you!